I just want you to know that last year, Bill Gates and I donated $28 billion to charity. You might also be interested to know that Michael Jordan and I have scored over 40,000 points playing basketball. Tiger Woods and I have shot approximately 19 holes in one. It's amazing what you can do when you are connected with a partner. Everything that I just claimed is true, but it may not tell the entire story. So did I really get a hole-in-one in golf? Sort of. In Jekyll Island, I teed off on a shot that was 150 yards away from the pin, and my shot went way off course. Hopelessly off course, and I saw it disappear deep into the woods. And I heard this clunk, and it bounced off of a palm tree, came flying out of the woods, landed on a sloping hill, made it all the way to the green, and rolled about 90 feet further into the cup. So Tiger has hit 18 holes in one, and I got a quasi hole in one. So together we've done 19 of them. On the physical plane, though, I should not really be linked with Bill Gates or Michael Jordan or Tiger Woods, but on the spiritual plane, God has chosen to partner with us. God has chosen to partner with us. And so we do have a relationship with Him. We have a partnership with Him. We do our part, and He does His part, which is certainly much more. If we take a look at Matthew 24, we can see some of the things that God has given us to do. A responsibility that's absolutely enormous and daunting, especially in the society, the world in which we live. Matthew 24:14. We can see it says in this gospel, it was prophesied of the kingdom of God to be preached to all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then the end shall come. Coupled with this is Matthew 28. We can turn there, chapter 28, verses 18 through 20. It says, "And Jesus came and spoke to them, saying, All power is given unto me in heaven and in earth. Go you therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things whatever I've commanded to you. And lo, I'm with you always until the end of the world." It's reassuring to know that if we are doing this, we are in harmony with God's will. But it is a very challenging job because we live in a secular society, and society has so many distractions, and there is natural opposition in many circles to fundamental Christianity. And that opposition is something that the ancients saw themselves. Elijah, Isaiah, Moses, Amos, they all encountered these things. But God has given us a great deal to do. An enormous job. And in order to succeed in that, God wants us wants to be our partner in doing His work. He wants to be our partner in doing His work. He doesn't tell us, you're on your own out there. By partner, I mean one who shares, a partaker, one associated with another, especially in the activity that accomplishes something. I do not know of a more significant work, more significant project, or responsibility that God has ever given anybody than what we can read about in the verses that we just looked at. God has always had a work for His people. And as Mr. Armstrong has said, people do grow to the extent that their heart is in the work. Over in the book of Joshua, let's look at an example of this partnership in action. God gave the Israelites the responsibility of coming into Canaan and taking that land. And it was to be a blessing to them. It would be their future home. And in Joshua chapter 6, it was time to do this. In Joshua 6, verse 1, it says, "And Jericho was straitly shut up because of the children of Israel. None went out and none came in." This nation of Israel basically encircled the city. "And the Lord said to Joshua, See that I've given your hand unto your hand, Jericho, and the king thereof, and the mighty men of valor. And you shall compass the city. You, men of war, go round the city, and you shall do this for 6 days. And seven priests shall bear before the ark seven trumpets of ram's horns. And on the seventh day you shall compass the city seven times. And the priests shall blow with the trumpets. And it shall come to pass that when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, all of the people will shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city will fall down flat, and people shall ascend from up every man straight before him. This was going to be the significant fall of the city of Jericho. And they were to give follow these explicit instructions that God gave through Joshua. So they marched around the city every day. This happened to occur during the days of unleavened bread. And on the last day of unleavened bread, they circled it seven times. Now, did they have to do this for Jericho to collapse? Did God need them to do anything at all? Well, obviously the answer is no. If God could create the universe and the angelic host and human beings and create a flood and create the stars in the heavens and everything else, well, surely he didn't need puny man to be able to march around the city in order for it to fall. He doesn't need man to do anything. God is all-powerful. He's omniscient. He's omnipotent. But he gave human beings a part to play. And so that was their part. But it was so important that they follow that, that if they did not follow instructions, nothing would happen. It's like when Moses was given the responsibility to speak to the rock so that it would bring forth water. In one particular miracle, he whacked the rock twice, and nothing happened for an uncomfortable number of minutes. So here, the people have a part to play, and they were willing to play it exactly the way they were instructed to. And in verse 20, it says, "And so the people shouted, when the priest blew the trumpets, and it came to pass that when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, and the people shouted with a great shout, that the wall fell down flat, so that the people went up to the city, every man running into the city and vanquishing the enemy." This was something that was played out because both sides did their respective responsibilities. The people had a small part to play, but they had to do it, and God backed up what he promised to. If we move over a couple of chapters, we go to chapter 10, and we read another experience with Joshua. Here he encountered the Amalekites and other people in the neighborhood of Philistia, and was engaged in warfare with them, again for the same purpose of taking over the promised land, the land of Canaan that God had intended for the Israelites to occupy. In Joshua chapter 10, we see in verse 8, when they were ready to fight, "The Lord said to Joshua, do not fear them, for I have delivered them into your hand, and there shall not be a man of them that stands before you. Joshua therefore came to them suddenly and went from Gilgal all night, marching. And that day the Lord discomfited the enemy before Israel and slew them with a great slaughter at Gibeon and chased them the way that goes up to Bethoron and smote them to Azekah and Makeda. And it came to pass as they fled from before the Israel from the armies of Joshua and were in the going down to Bethoron, that the Lord cast down great stones of heaven, hailstones probably, upon the people that they died. And notice this, there were more that died with the hailstones than they of the children of Israel, they that were slain by the children of Israel. Then spoke Joshua to the Lord in the day that the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel. And he said in the sight of Israel, this was an idea that Joshua had. The war could continue to go on, the battle that is, but they were running out of daylight. And so Joshua said, "Sun, stand still upon Gibeon, and you, moon, stand still in the valley of Ajalon." And so the sun stood still and the moon stayed until the people avenged themselves upon their enemies. And so the sun stood still in the midst of the heaven and did not go down by a whole day. That had to be so incredible. Incredible that people would continue to fight and the sun would not move. It was the longest day. I'm sure the enemies of the Israelites were thinking, this is not going well for us. We have to retreat. But certainly nighttime, it'll be different. Or we can regroup. And then hours later, it's like it's still 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I do not understand this. And they would go on for hours more, and it had to be exhausting. And they were starting to cave in and retreat, and they were moving away from the highlands back toward the Mediterranean Sea. Verse 14 says, "And there was no day like it before it or after that, that the Lord hearkened to the voice of a man, for the Lord fought for Israel." I find this fascinating, the fact that it was Joshua's idea to extend the daylight portion. And God honored that. Was Joshua victorious? Was Israel victorious? Of course. But who gets the credit? Well, obviously it was God. Well, the Israelites did their part. Yes, Israel did its part. But as we saw in verse 11, God slew more people through the hailstones than what the Israelites did on the ground. In other words, God's contribution to the cause was far greater than that of mankind. But they had an important part to play. They were partners in this relationship, and they exercised their responsibilities. And as a result, there was success. It is important that both sides of the equation, both the master partner as well as the junior partners, do their particular respective parts. And when it works together, marvelous things can happen or success can be achieved. We move on over to Exodus 17. See another example that illustrates the same thing, the same principle. Exodus 17 in verse 8. As I mentioned before, God, through all the ages, has given a work for His people to do. There's always been some responsibility. Sometimes that has changed. Noah was asked to build an ark and to, according to Josephus, warn the world for 120 years. Theoretically, or possibly gathering material for 40 years, building the ark for 40 years, and then proclaiming a message of warning for 40 years, according to Josephus. That's not the same as quoting the Bible, but it is possible that that happened that way. But we do know that Noah was given a job to do, and he worked as if it all depended on him. And if he slept off, he might have suffered with the rest of humanity. But instead, he took God's word seriously, and he did his part, and then God did his part. Here in Exodus 17, again, the Israelites were fighting against the Amalekites, and an unusual thing was discovered here by Moses. He realized that when he would pray and lift up his arms, that the Israelites prevailed against the enemy. And so he soon realized that he needed to keep his arms up in the air for the success to continue. In Exodus 17, verse 8, we read the following. "And then came Amalek and fought with Israel in Rephidim. And Moses said to Joshua, 'Choose us out men and go out and fight with Amalek. And tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand.' So Joshua did as Moses had said to him, and fought with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went to the top of the hill. And when it came to pass that Moses held up his hand, that Israel prevailed. And when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed." And that had to be sobering to think, wow, the future or the lives of different people are at stake. And not only at stake, dependent on whether my arms are up in the air or lowered. So I've got to keep them up there. I've got to, if that's directly proportionate to how successful my fellow brethren are on the ground fighting the enemy. So that's the way Moses felt. But of course, his hands and his arms became heavy. An average person, I've read in different accounts, can probably keep arms up for about 15 minutes. And then after that, with the lack of blood flow and waning of strength, it's almost impossible to continue past that point. And this was a battle that was going to go on for hours. And so, it's when Moses' hands were heavy, Aaron and Hur, two assistants to Moses that were right there in verse 12, they took a stone and put it under these arms and perhaps physically helped keep them up in the air. And Moses sat there on, and Aaron and Hur stayed up the hands, one on one side, one on the other, and his hands were steady till the going down of the sun. And Joshua discomfited Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. And it's, the Lord said to Moses, write this for a memorial in a book and rehearse this in the days of Joshua, for I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalekite from under heaven. That was an important principle that is carried down to our day. And we've understood this, and sometimes people have said, figuratively speaking, we need to hold the hands up of those that are leading us. Maybe those at the home office, or in years gone by, Mr. Armstrong. That it would be impossible for them to do everything that was required on their own, and they would need help, and they would need support of others. So they would be dependent on God for God to do His part, and they might be also dependent on other junior partners to be able to lift up their hands to help do what the church was responsible to do, or do what the nation of Israel was responsible to do. Regardless of the century, there are different responsibilities for God's people as junior partners in the relationship with God. Aaron and Hur realized that if they didn't do their job, that Moses' arms would be so exhausted they would collapse and people would die. So there was a lot at stake. God did not need them. He could have taken care of the enemy all by himself in a split second. Or he could have rained hailstones. But he gives people a part to play. It helps for their spiritual growth. Helps for them to have confidence in God. It helps when we need to go to God that we realize we have an enormous senior partner who has all the power that can make marvelous things happen. And from time to time, we need that. We need that. In 2 Chronicles chapter 20, 2 Chronicles chapter 20 is one of the most fascinating accounts that you'll find in the Bible as far as a relationship where the people trust in God. They do what God had required for them to do, which was significant, although it was very, very small compared to God's part. And then God did the rest. 2 Chronicles chapter 20 and verse 1. We read here, it says, and it came to pass, after this also, the children of Moab, the children of Ammon, and with them the children of the Ammonites, came against Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, to battle. This was a threat to the very existence of the nation of Judah. Three major nations that had a superior military force, and amalgamating this military force, threatened to come to Judah and to extinguish that country, wipe it off the face of the map. And its king, fortunately, had a relationship with God and was very concerned that God would intervene. In verse 2, it says, and it came to pass that someone told Jehoshaphat, saying, there comes a great multitude against you from beyond the sea on this side of Syria, and behold, they be in Hazatamar, which is in Engedi. This would be about 20 miles south of Jericho. They would be maybe 40 miles away from the city of Jerusalem. And they were marching up with all the confidence in the world. And this, the Jews understood, would be a major, major threat to its existence. Verse 3, and Jehoshaphat the king feared, and he set himself to seek the Lord, to proclaim a fast throughout all of Judah. A wise decision. He knew the spiritual state of the country, and he knew that the country was not as close to God as it needed to be. They had been committing serious problems, creating problems, and drifting from God. And he realized it was not accidental that they were in a bind. So Jehoshaphat realized, we need to go to our senior partner, somebody with all the power. We need to be in harmony with his ways and trust for him to make up for what we lack. to make up for what we lack. And here, verse 4, Judah gathered together itself to ask for help from the Lord. And they came. Jews came from out of the cities of Judah. And they came down to this location. This would defy common sense militarily. You wouldn't leave your strong fortress of Jerusalem to come out into a desert and against an enemy that had the potential determination to attack you, to be in a weakened state, to be fasting, and to have children, women, everybody. This was putting it all on the line. They were looking to a spiritual solution. That it was either God is going to help us or we die. They were trusting in God. This was an act of faith. Of course, they had a faithful leader that encouraged this. And they didn't want to oppose the king. In verse 5, Jehoshaphat stood in the congregation of Judah and Jerusalem and in the house of the Lord before the new court. Well, I mentioned that they were coming out to the scene of the battle. I should revise that to say that while some of them did, the rest were assembling now together. They knew that they were under siege. They knew that their existence was at stake. In verse 6, Jehoshaphat prayed a powerful prayer. He said, O God of our fathers, are you not the God in heaven? And do you not, you know, the God of heaven, you're omnipotent. You rule over the celestial galaxies and the angelic hosts and everyone. And you rule not over the kingdoms of the heathen? It's interesting he uses that word. He's reminding them, you know, and we know our track record isn't that great. But you are the ruler over the universe, including the heathen. I mean, those three nations ready to come against us, they're heathen. They're not obeying you. He's trying to encourage God to realize that Judah was in a better state than these other pagan nations, that trying to persuade God to intervene on their behalf. And is it not in your hand to be able to do things, that there's none that is able to withstand you? Are you not our God who did drive out the inhabitants of this land before the people of Israel in the past and gave it to the seed of Abraham, your friend forever? Very, very persuasive. He's saying, you know, you were friends with Abraham, and you thought the world of him, and you promised to do wonderful things for him. And this is in keeping with that. You would want to take care of the people now, because they're descendants of Abraham. And you've promised to give this land to the Israelites. So please intervene for us now, because it's all being threatened to be taken away. Verse 8, and they dwelt therein, and they have built you a sanctuary there for your name, saying, if when evil comes upon us as the sword or judgment or pestilence or famine, we stand before this house, before the temple, and in your presence, for your name is in this house, and we cry to you in our affliction, that you will hear and help. And now look, all the children of Ammon and Moab and the Mount Seir, whom you would not let Israel invade, and when they came out of the land of Egypt, and they turned away from them and destroyed them not, behold, I say how they are rewarding us to come against, cast us out of our possession, or your possessions you've given us. O Lord our God, will you not judge them? For we have no might against this great company that comes against us. Neither know we what to do, but our eyes are upon you. And all Judah stood before the Lord with their children, their wives, little ones. That had to be a very moving experience. In heaven, God saw what was going to happen, and Jehoshaphat was right. These were the descendants of the people that he promised would enter the and live and occupy in the land of Canaan. And they were ready to be blown out of existence. And they were helpless. They weren't sharpening their spears. They weren't deciding, let's form a stronger army. They realized they needed extra help. They decided to take advantage of the partnership that they had with God. They had not been doing that for a long time. Some were drifting toward pagan idolatry and other practices. But now, under crunch time, they reevaluated their situation. They realized, we know where we stand. We are supposed to have a partnership with our God. And our leader, Joshua, is convinced that he has the power to help us. And on paper, we see no other way out. We're outnumbered, we're outgunned, we're outmanned. We have no military, not like they do, and we're in trouble. So they looked to God, and they were in earnest about that. And they were candid. Verse 14, then upon Jahaziel, son of Zechariah, son of Benaniah, a Levite, came the Spirit of the Lord in the midst of the congregation and said, "Hearken, you all of Judah, you inhabitants of Jerusalem, and you king of Jehoshaphat. Thus saith the Lord, be not afraid nor dismayed by reason of this great multitude, for the battle is not yours but God's. Tomorrow go down against them. Behold, they come by the cliff of Ziz, and you shall find them at the end of the brook before the wilderness of Jeruel. You need not fight this battle. You need not do God's job." In other words, set yourself, stand you still, and see the salvation of the Lord with you, O Judah and Jerusalem. Fear not, nor be dismayed, for tomorrow go out against them, for the Lord will be with you. I will summarize what happened. They never had to lift a spear against this mighty army. Instead, for whatever reason, this army of three different groups got into a misunderstanding or an argument, and they started to fight each other. Perhaps it was at night, but they thought perhaps that the Israelites were attacking them. But in the night, they fought, and they killed each other off. And so when the Jews went out to see what had happened, they saw an indeterminable amount of dead bodies strewn across the desert. And for the next 3 days, they spoiled these people. They took different possessions, and gold and silver. And it was an amazing thing. They didn't have to proverbially fire a shot. The master partner of the relationship took care of everything. And we have cited examples like this to demonstrate why we, at this point, believe in conscientious objectorship. We do not fight the wars of this world. And that was something that Israel had to learn. And here was an example where God says, you don't have to do your part any further than what you've done. Now, what was the part that they played? They prayed. They fasted. They humbly repented. They sang praises to God. And militarily, they stood down. That was what they did. That was their responsibility. A small part to play, you might say? Very, very significant, though, nonetheless. Very, very significant. I will not turn there, but because we don't have the book, but in the autobiography of Mr. Armstrong, he had times where he needed God's help, and he needed it immediately. And sometimes he would work instead as if it all depended on him. And yet he knew that if God were not in the picture, his part wouldn't matter. There was a time when he was in Iowa, in Des Moines, Iowa, and this was in the 1940s, and I might have used this once here, but it so speaks to what I'm talking about. He was tired. He'd traveled halfway across the country and was to do a live program, which was required occasionally by these different radio stations. And so he gave it the best effort that he could. And he was hoping that he could do a fine presentation and they might get 200 responses from all over the country on this 50,000-watt radio station. And the further he got into the program, the more tired he felt. He just didn't have the energy, the zip. He had been washed out in a sense, tired, on the road, and he kept forcing himself to try to be enthusiastic. And he gave this message for 30 minutes. When he was done, he felt pretty empty about his performance. And to make matters worse, one of the managers of the station came and said, "Mr. Armstrong, this effort of yours just wasn't that good tonight. Why, don't you realize that WHO is a very prestigious station? And usually you do much better." And he wrote and said, "I only know that this was true. And I felt just terrible about it." But he did his best under the trying circumstances. And he wrote that evening, It was one of the coldest days of the winter. And on very, very cold days in January, in the ionosphere, radio waves have extra bounce, and they have extra coverage. And apparently, his weak broadcast that he gave with his might was so extensive that it reached all 50 states. They got responses from all 50 states. Normally it would be 200 letters. It was 2,200 letters. God magnified because God is the master partner. Mr. Armstrong did everything he could. And when you do everything you can, you look up to heaven, you say, God, you're the master partner. Please make up for what I lack. He can do that, and he will do that. He made up for what Judah lacked with King Jehoshaphat, and he helped Mr. Armstrong. Now, one other time, Mr. Armstrong was in Denver, and he was looking to line up another radio station. In the 1940s and 50s, he did a great deal of that, traveling constantly and talking to different people. He said it was his custom to always pray before he would walk into a station in order to have grace and favor with the manager. But he said I was understandably quite busy, and he forgot to do that. And he met the manager in the morning. And he said it just didn't go well. He says, I felt like I was talking to a brick wall. It just didn't work. He wasn't impressed. Finally, we broke for lunch. And then he said, I realized I hadn't prayed about it. So he scrambled and went somewhere and did just that. Then he came back and was glad that the whole interchange between dialogue had not come to an abrupt end before lunch. He picked it up with this man, and everything seemed to flow together. Well, yes, I think we can clear a time for you to have this program. What would you say to Sunday at such and such a time and all? And it worked out beautifully. So, unless the Lord builds the house, the weary toilers can toil in vain. It's always about God and what God can do. We saw this a decade ago in the United Kingdom. An example I've used once before, but it speaks again to this theme. We ran an ad, we thought, in Reader's Digest. The ad was, we had enough money to cover 1/10 of the British Isles. They forgot to run the ad. They called somebody up and said, we are so sorry, but we'll make it up to you. If you will let us run the ad next month, we'll run it in all 10 sections. We'll cover the entire British Isles for the same money. That's what can happen when God is behind something. And I think that we credit God with making that possible. Sometimes God will reduce expense in order to make things happen. In Salt Lake City, there was a need to move out of a very expensive hall there. And so the minister, Rock Corbett, said to the people, let's see what we can do. Let's see what our master partner will do for us. But we have to do our part, he said. So let's form ourselves an army, and we'll all ferret out through the city of Salt Lake, and we will see what we can find for options for a hall rental. And as it turned out, they looked over 100 locations, investigated those, seemed to be ready to settle on one, and as the pastor was on his way by car to sign the contract, he just felt like pulling into this particular American Legion Hall, and was amazed it was modern and had nice facilities. And to make a long story short, they decided there, the management, to work with the church. They said that they wanted somebody for Saturday. They didn't, because they had everything booked up on Sunday. The bottom line was that the church now has that contract for half the money, almost, that they were paying at the other place. And they have more hours. They have a kitchen. It's a beautiful location. And it's only one exit away from where they met before. Not only that, they said to him, we feel insecure just having you here. You could leave on us. So for this low amount of money, would you mind signing an 8-year lease?
Well, if we have to, we have to. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Before you change your mind. And so I had the opportunity. God gets all the credit. I was asked, can we find something less expensive in Fort Myers? And I hadn't. So I went down. I didn't know where to go. What plan do you have? Well, we'll just start at one side of the city and drive around and talk to people and call people up and work your way. I started north, went south. I felt totally inadequate. I'm in a place where I don't know where anything is. And so by the afternoon, came across one location. End result, they're willing to rent it out and save it for about 40% savings on where we had it before, and the same exit, same basic location. Only God can take the credit for that. He's got a huge shovel. I might have a little spade. It's all about God. And so I was involved in that, but that could have been you or you or you or anybody. Anybody. We have a minister, we have a deacon over in Orlando who goes down to the country of Suriname. He was down there recently and during Unleavened Bread, and he was trying to get on a radio station. He had a 5-minute presentation made by the church that would be effective. And so he went to the major religious station, and they didn't want to give him the time of day. They put him off. They thought it was crazy. And he could have been more discouraged by their response to his efforts. But he decided, well, I'm not going to let that keep me down. I'll go to the secular radio station, a new and a popular station that was features conservative talk programming. And so he went in there, and he maintained an air of confidence, and he said, I would like to present a piece of information from the United Church of God, and I'm asking that you'll run this every day. And they said, well, you don't understand. We're not a religious station. You need to go try the people, you know, down the street. No, I think this will be very good for you. And so they thought about it. He says, well, I'll talk to my staff. And he came back and he said, it's a deal. You're on. We'll run your 5-minute presentation. And not only that, and this surprised our friend, in one sense, he didn't have to pay for it. We'll do it for free for the Holy Week. That's what they called it. Easter. Easter was began the Holy Week. For us, it was Unleavened Bread, but he didn't get into that. Now, a number of people might say, well, this is great news. I'm glad to have this this offer. And so we'll do it for once a week. I mean, for 1 week. But instead, he argued with them. He says, no, can't be just for a week. It's got to be a month. Because that's what you do when you sign contracts with anybody, is you go a month. Well, we were just going to do the Holy Week. But you have to do a month. Well, I'll talk it over with the staff. And then they came back with, okay, we'll do it, but you would have to pay. Normally it's $35 a minute, but we'll just charge you $35 for the program. So here was a door that a church member leaned on, and he kept leaning on it until it swung all the way open, and all of this unfolded. It's just amazing, when God is behind it, what can happen? If you've ever had the opportunity of being at the Ambassador College campus in Pasadena, California, you know that that whole thing came together as one large or one series of major miracles. One of the most amazing miracles to me was the acquisition of the Hewlett-Merritt Mansion, a mansion that was built in 1905 for $1.1 million and had exotic woods, teak woods, and marble, and just the choicest building material available at the time, brought in from all over the world. And the millionaire Hewlett Merritt, who was an inheritor to his family, owned the Mesabi iron ore range in Minnesota. He was wealthy, and so he had that mansion was built, and he occupied it. By the time he died, it was worth at least six times that in 1956. And it was going up for absolute auction. There were a number of heirs that would have greedily grabbed that, but they thought that if we put it up for auction, we'll get a lot more money. For whatever reason, hardly anybody bid on it. The church got it for less than it would cost to build a fence around it, for $11,000. And the price revalued many times since then. Let's take a look at Luke chapter 1 and verse 37. And that was just one property. There were numerous others that had marvelous stories behind them. Luke chapter 1 and verse 37. Luke 1 verse 37. It says, "For with God nothing shall be impossible." If you know where he's working, there are places where he's not working. He's not working with the mafia. He's not working where people are steeped in great paganism. He was never involved in an activity of human sacrifice or endless warfare that we see around the world. But when you understand his will and the fact that he's doing a work, and you get in harmony with that, you see great things happen. You see a master partner be able with a huge shovel to provide what we ourselves are unable to do. Sometimes we just forget about it. We take it for granted. Oh, he did a great thing long ago. And we don't realize that he is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Malachi 3:6, Hebrews 13:8, yesterday, today, forever. God does not change. So with all things are possible with God. And you can see that in Matthew 19, verse 26, it repeats that. Another experience that Mr. Armstrong had, again, in the 1940s, after the college was established, he was basically living out of his car with his family and bouncing from one motel to the next, trying to eke out a living, save money to keep the church alive, keep the college going. These were lean years. He was doing everything that he could. But how much longer could you drag four kids and a wife through that kind of a harrowing experience? Maybe it wasn't the right choice, but he was trying to do the best he could. He had no blueprint like, here are the easy steps to building a college and a work of God. He was learning as he was stumbling along and trusting in God, walking by faith and not by sight. And as it came, he realized the need was great to finally have a house for himself. I will just summarize this. He ended up with a place that was on Hill Street and in middle of Pasadena and only a few miles away from the campus. And the owners wanted to sell for a certain price. They fell in love with Loma Armstrong and thought, wow, she and this house go together. They want her to have it. And he was discouraged. Mr. Armstrong said, look, to the realtor, you're the one that asked me to come here. I tell you, we don't have any money for a down payment. This isn't making sense at all. There's no sense in getting our hopes up for something that just isn't available to us because it's out of our reach. We're not in a position to buy a house. And no, you need to see this. I think they'll work with you. To make a long story short, yes, the people wanted them to have the house. They owned it free and clear. And so they decided to hold a mortgage. And the person drawing up the mortgage said, Mr. Armstrong, I feel like a criminal writing up this contract because they're telling me they don't want any money down. They'll take quarterly payments. There's no interest on this property. And they're selling it to you for half of what the realtor was trying to sell it for to everybody else. I feel like a criminal. I don't think I should do this, but they've authorized me to, so I have to. And then he said, you know what? This is the second major property you've acquired this month without a down payment. Well, was it he that did it, or was it God behind him? And if he did it then, isn't he the same God here in the time in which we live? There was always a part to play. He did what he could. He didn't have much. Think of the Naaman who was told by Elisha, was it, to go dip in the Jordan River seven times. And then he would find out whether or not his leprosy was still with him. And he had his doubts. But But that was his part to play. A small part to play, but it was a responsibility. Had Naaman not dipped into the Jordan River 7 times, he would have continued to have and maybe die of his leprosy. But instead, he followed those simple instructions and he was healed. God did the lion's share of what had to happen. It was a partnership that worked. If in the New Testament, remember the example of the 5 barley loaves and the 2 fishes that were multiplied by Christ, God could have said, you know what, I'll just rain manna down. Why should they go through the motion of collecting these fish and pieces of bread? But they had a part to play. God chose that. Chose that. As the perfect senior partner, he says in Hebrews 13, I will never leave you nor forsake you. He has not changed. Do we take full advantage of it? I explained one time that there was a couple that lived at the turn of the century, 1900, in the nation of Wales. They were hooked up to electricity, and after a half of a year, the company came out, representatives, and said, hey, what's the story? You're hardly using any electricity. Don't you realize that you can run gadgets with it? Why, you could get an icebox that runs on electricity. You could have a blender. You can even have electric lights. There is no limit to what you could do day or night if you just take advantage of the electricity that's coming into your home. And the answer was, well, we're glad we have the electricity because when it gets dark, we turn the lights on to find our kerosene lamps. And then we light the lamps and shut off the electric lights. Might have to replace them one day. Of course, the smell of kerosene, I guess, didn't bother them in their living room and everywhere else. But that's the way they looked at it. They never took advantage of the electricity that was available. It was sad if people don't take advantage of God's Holy Spirit. And we've talked about that, extolled the value of it last week. Something not to forget. Now, when I refer to Mr. Armstrong from time to time, it's not because I think he should rule from the grave or that he had every last policy correct. If he were still alive, he'd be 120 years of age at this point. Sometimes people criticized him of Armstrong extravagance, that he's hobnobbing with the rich, going overseas. I remember him saying, "You think this is fun?" Nobody really said that. He said, it's a hassle getting out of bed. It's no fun being this old and having these aches and pains. And he would talk about the need for people to pray for him, to hold up his hands. But he also said something else that I think is incredible. He said, I've accomplished more in these last couple of years of my life than I've had accomplished in any other time. This is when his eyesight was terrible. He came to Orlando a year before he died. We gave him the gift of Steuben crystal in the form of grapes, and he held them up to his eyes. He couldn't even see what they were. He couldn't hear. He was anemic. He was near death. What were his fruits? Well, he had the number one mass circulation magazine of the world, and he had the second largest, was fast becoming the number one religious telecast based on the Arbitron ratings. We had, before he died, a generation of up to 200 visit requests in some metropolitan areas of the country. We've never seen that since, although maybe we will one day. He was establishing personal contact with scores of world leaders. What other junior partner of God has ever been able to do that? He was not idling and spiritual neutral. In my opinion, no, he wasn't perfect. Nobody is. Mr. Armstrong was the most successful junior partner that God has ever had in the last century. I don't think it's a tragedy that he one day died. It's appointed once every man to die, Hebrews 9:27. However, it would be a tragedy if we failed to learn to emulate all the successful principles that he employed as a terrific junior partner. A number of times we get into perplexing difficulties. We have real issues to deal with, health, money, especially. And sometimes I think we need to go to our senior partner and say, help remove all roadblocks so there's nothing between me and you, so that I can go to you just like other people have, Moses, Elijah, Mr. Armstrong, whoever, and get the results I need. Sometimes you gotta have it. They'll say that in sports, you know. We need a clutch shot. Gotta have it now. You know, 10 seconds left on the clock. Gotta have it. There are times when we have certain needs. And I know that's the case. And maybe we're not milking our relationship as much as we could. In Jehoshaphat's case, Israel, Judah that is, was not in as strong a position as he would have wished. It would have been easier if he could have said, Father in heaven, my country has been so zealous. They've been not working to the bone day and night for you. And they've been fasting on a regular basis. They've been crying out to you. And this is, this is crunch time. Make it happen. Please intervene now. No, they were less than perfect, and yet with persuasive, powerful, earnest prayer, Jehoshaphat got the answer that he needed, and Judah was spared. Maybe that was a real spiritual springboard for a number of the other junior partners. We need to be in harmony with our senior partner. We need to carry out his will. And the great work that we've done involves preaching the gospel and preparing a people. That's encapsulated in the motto of the church. And the inspiration to do so comes from that same source, our senior partner. And just like other junior partners before us, Moses, Elijah, the apostles, Apostle Paul, the prophets, they all learned to be effective instruments in God's hands. They all learned how they could go to God time and time again and get unlimited help for whatever needs they had. Because for us to be able to continue to do the work, God has to take care of our needs too. And we can sort of hope that he will, or kind of casually pray that he might, or we can be earnestly in prayer all the time saying, look, this is not a fake relationship. This is real. I expect an answer because I'm trying to be in harmony with what you show to be workable. Let's be interested in that. Let's be excited and rally behind the relationship that we have with God. And so he will do his part when we do our part. Isaiah 55, in closing, Isaiah 55, verses 10 and 11, we can read. For as the rain comes down, and the snow from heaven, and returns not there, but waters the earth, and makes it to bring forth and bud, that it might give seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goes forth out of my mouth. It shall not return to me void, but it shall accomplish that which I please and shall prosper in the thing whereunto I sent it. That's the way it is with God. When we do our part and support him, his greater part will he provide to make the relationship successful and to complete the work that he's given us to do. The question that we must ask is, will we become the most valuable junior partners that we can possibly be to make that happen?